This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell by Robert Dugoni, performed by the author. For my mother, Patty Brannick Dugoni, who gave me my love of reading and my passion for writing. None of this would have been possible without your unconditional love, support, and faith. I could not have asked for a better childhood or better parents. Thank you for making my life extraordinary. There comes a day in every man's life when he stops looking forward and starts looking back. Maxwell Hill. Forward. My mother called it God's will. At those moments in my life when things did not go as I had hoped or planned, and there were many, she would say, "It's God's will, Samuel." This was hardly comforting to a 6-year-old boy, even one blessed with a healthier dose of perspective than most children at that age. For one, I never understood how my mother knew God's will. When I would ask her that very question, she would answer with another of her stock refrains. Have faith, Samuel. I realize now that this was circular reasoning impregnable to debate. My mother might just as well have responded with that other impenetrable parental reply, because I said so. Now, as an adult with that healthy dose of perspective we call experience, I realize my mother was right, as she so often was when it came to my life. We think we have control over our lives, especially when we're young and seemingly invulnerable. We're told we can do anything we set our minds to, that the world is our oyster, that all we have to do is shuck the hard shell and pluck the rich, nourishing meat inside. I realize now, however, that the shell is a lot harder than I appreciated, and that I never could have controlled or even predicted the things that would happen in my life. We believe we choose the paths we take, when we come to those forks in our lives, the friends we make, the careers we undertake, the spouses we marry. But we don't. Life is either a collision of random events, like billiard balls during a break careening off and into one another, or, if you are so inclined to believe, our predetermined fate, what my mother took such great comfort in calling God's will. I desperately wanted to believe my mother was right. I wanted to believe God had a plan for me when David Bateman hit me in the face with a rubber ball on the schoolyard playground and placed us on a cataclysmic course, ultimately leading to his death. I wanted to believe God sent Ernie Cantwell from Detroit, Michigan, the only African-American child in my class, to be the friend I so desperately needed. I wanted to believe it had been God's design that Mickey Kennedy would storm into my life in the 6th grade like a Midwest tornado, uprooting every precept I'd been taught about the roles of boys and girls and toppling the Catholic ideology my mother and the nuns at Our Lady of Mercy spoon-fed us as a remedy for every personal and societal ailment. Mostly, I wanted to believe that I was fated to live the extraordinary life my mother so ardently believed I was destined for. The life she dutifully prayed for each night as she sat on our floral couch in our wood-paneled family room, kneading the beads of her rosary. Was it God's will that I should buy this house just 2 blocks from the shingled home in which I was raised and live in a town I had once sought desperately to escape? I thought I purchased my home because it was a sound investment, a plot of land in an up-and-coming real estate market. My parents had not been so practical. My mother's only real estate criteria had been that our home be within walking distance of a Catholic church and school. The end result, however, has been the same. Except for a decade when I fled, I have lived my entire life close enough to hear the bells ringing in the steeple of Our Lady of Mercy Catholic Church. And yet, despite my proximity, I can only recall hearing those bells on a handful of occasions. Today was one of those times. And for some unknown reason, fate, destiny, or perhaps, God's will. The toll of those bells has compelled me to sit at this keyboard and write of my mother and father, and of David Bateman, of Daniela and Trina Crouch, and, of course, of Ernie and Mickey. The sound of those bells has even provided me with a logical place to start this story, my story. A memory of another day when I heard those same bells, or thought I did. Part 1. A Stain on the Carpet. 1. 1989, Burlingame, California. The bell sounded so clear they caused me to sit up, though intuitively I knew I could not have heard them in that sterile, cramped doctor's office. Everything okay? Dr. Kenji Fukumara peered at me over his glasses, an inquisitive gaze. It was an interesting question given my circumstances. I sat on a narrow examination table, one sheet of thin paper crinkling beneath me, and a second sheet draped over my naked lower half. That morning I'd shaved my groin in anticipation of my vasectomy, a task in which I had taken great care. During an earlier consult, Dr. Fukumara told me a story of how a particularly hairy patient caught fire during the cauterization, and the doctor immediately commenced to beat at the flames. Urban myth, probably, but the image of Dr. Fukumara pounding my groin with his fist had caused me to be precise. So instead of asking if he, too, had heard the church bells, I said, "Can we wait a minute?" "It's perfectly natural to be nervous," Dr. Fukumara said. He stood at a stainless steel sink, scrubbing his hands with disinfectant soap and rinsing them beneath a stream of hot water. "I just need a moment." I sat up farther, the paper beneath me protesting. The bells had sounded exactly like those that rang in the steeple of Our Lady of Mercy, the Catholic church just blocks from my boyhood home, which made me think of my mother, whom I'd always considered more infallible than the Pope when it came to Catholic ideology. Though I was no longer practicing Catholic, the remnants of her steadfast tutelage, like those bells, still occasionally rang loud and clear. Catholic guilt, they call it. My mother would have chastised my decision to get a vasectomy as a violation of a church tenet. "Is there something in particular, some concern?" Dr. Fukumara asked, drying his hands with a coarse brown paper towel. "I wish there was," I said. "Something particular, I mean." "You won't have any change in sexual function." He'd given me the same assurance in our consult. "And you'll still be able to pee like a racehorse." As well as the same joke. Dr. Fukumara smiled easily. Humor was his technique to put his patients at ease, a necessity when your specialty involved cutting other men's scrotums. The week before, when he walked into that same room for my 15-minute consult, he'd held a machete and had donned Coke bottle-thick magic store glasses. "This won't hurt a bit," he deadpanned. "Is it your wife?" he asked. "Is she having second thoughts?" "Oh, no. She's very sure," I said, though Eva was not my wife. Eva and I had lived together in the house I'd bought 2 blocks from the church I no longer attended, with the steeple bells I no longer heard, except at odd moments, like that one. Eva moving in with me had seemed like a good idea at the time, but as the months had passed, our living arrangement had started to feel like it was more for convenience than love, which, ironically, was how I had pitched her the idea. "You won't have to pay rent," I'd rationalized, "and we'll save on utilities and groceries and other incidentals." It was all very practical. "What about your mother?" had been Eva's reply. From my mother's perspective, Eva and I were living in sin. She'd never used those words, but she'd also never set foot in my house from the moment Eva did. And on those rare occasions when the three of us got together, usually for dinner at a restaurant, my mother was cordial, but never asked about the details of Eva's and my relationship. Neither did I. Eva and I had discussed marriage, but always in vague terms that also usually provoked a reference to my mother. "I won't get married just to appease her," Eva had said, "and when I do, it won't be in a Catholic church either." Eva's use of the pronoun I as opposed to we, was not lost on me. Nor was the fact that Eva always seemed to refer to my mother when the subject of marriage came up, and never to us. Dr. Fukumara smiled and walked closer to the table. And you? What's that? I asked, having missed his question. Are you having second thoughts? Do you have kids? I asked. Three boys, he said. We sent our last off to college in September. We're officially empty nesters. We can run around the house naked and have sex in any room. Do you? I asked. His smile waned. How old are your children? I don't have any, I said, which seemed to give him pause. He fixed me again with that inquisitive look. I was just 32. Eva was 3 years older, a pilot for Alaska Airlines committed to her career and uncertain she wanted children, though apparently very certain she did not want mine. Hence my shaved groin and decision to end my chance to be a father. And you think you still might want to? I don't know. I didn't think I did. I told myself as much for most of my adult life, but now, at the moment of decision, I was no longer so certain. Dr. Fukumara nodded. Listen, I schedule these at the end of my day. I have another patient in the room next door. Think it over. I'll be back in 45 minutes. But even after Dr. Fukumara had left the room, I could not think it over. Not with my past continuing to invade my present. The first recollection started as a trickle that, as soon as I attempted to block it, found another path to weep through, the way water will always bleed through concrete, no matter how many times you patch it. I was recalling a particular moment on an unusually hot summer day when I'd sat beside my father in the shade of a 200-year-old oak tree. It had become our routine to sit in the shade provided by those gnarled branches and broad leaves, my father listening in his wheelchair. I don't remember much else about that day, or even the topic of conversation, but I do remember his words. There comes a time in every man's life, he'd said in the halting, ghostly voice his stroke had left him, when he stops looking forward and starts looking back. I recall thinking my father too young to be imparting such wisdom, despite his infirmity, and I too young to be receiving it. Now, sitting in Dr. Fukumara's office, I wondered if I had already reached that time in my life. The thought frightened me, because I had done very little to leave a mark on this world. My death would be noted with nothing more than a headstone bearing the dates of my birth and my death to let the world know I had been here. I am the only son of an only son. My father's lineage will end with me. And as that thought weighed on me, I decided for no rational reason that I hated that room with its mustard yellow walls and poorly disguised cheap pressboard cabinets. I slid off the table and paced the orange linoleum, imagining what Eva might say when she arrived home from her East Coast flight to find I had changed my mind. We talked about this, she'd say. We agreed. But saying we agreed was akin to saying the French and British agreed to give Germany most of Czechoslovakia at the Munich conference. I had grown weary of Eva's complaints about how condoms numbed the pleasure for her, and how a vasectomy was the least intrusive and most effective form of birth control. For her, certainly. But she was not the one facing the blade, or worse, a possible fire and Dr. Fukumara's beating fists. My eyes wandered to the stainless steel metal stand and the gleaming forceps, tweezers, and scalpels. The two mountains of gauze seemed far more than necessary given the small task to be performed. And I again thought of my father, who had never had to make this decision. I know what he would have said if I had ever confided in him about this trip to the doctor. My father would have said what he always said when my actions dumbfounded him. The same four words he uttered the very first moment he'd laid eyes on me and unwittingly bestowed upon me my name. What the Sam hell? 2. Burlingame, California. I'd heard the story of my birth so often I could recount it as if I actually recalled the event. For some unknown reason, my mother always chose to begin with the weather.
March 15th, 1957 was a cold and clear winter day of little or no consequence until, she'd say, leaning forward on the couch and pressing the palms of her hands together, the college actress performing, "I felt a kick."
This had apparently occurred shortly after my father sat in his favorite recliner to read the newspaper and nurse his evening indulgence, a single Manhattan.
"What did you do?"
I'd asked from my spot on the carpet at her feet. "I ignored you," my mother would say, feigning indifference with a dramatic pause and a wave of her hand. "After all, we weren't expecting you for another 5 weeks." She would then reenact how she had rearranged the two decorative pillows at the small of her back while sitting in her customary spot on the sofa, kneading the beads of her rosary. "And when the pain returned, I offered it up for some poor soul trapped in purgatory." I learned at a very young age that purgatory was the nebulous place between heaven and earth where the dead must be purified of sin through the prayers of others before St. Peter allows entrance through heaven's pearly gates. "Give it up for some poor soul in purgatory" would be my mother's mantra in response to any suffering I would endure throughout my childhood, though I don't recall a single instance in which it proved particularly effective. It certainly didn't rid her of the pain I was to inflict that evening and most of the following day. That my mother had been praying the rosary, however, came as no surprise. My mother was always in the midst of a novena to the Blessed Mother for one thing or another, including the time the water heater quit and we couldn't afford a new one. I never asked if she believed the Blessed Mother would drop a new jet glass from the heavens. My mother would have admonished me for being sacrilegious. But such was the depth of her faith and her devotion. Much later, after my mother's death, I found her tiny blue novena book in the drawer of her nightstand with an incalculable number of lead pencil marks to record each of her 54-day novenas. "And don't forget how you groaned," my father would chime in from behind his newspaper. "I didn't groan," my mother would say. "You make me sound like a barnyard cow." With that, my father would peek at me from behind his newspaper and smile. My mother prided herself as a descendant of the toughest of Irish stock, but somewhere in the middle of the third decade of the Joyful Mysteries, her water broke, and I could no longer be ignored. "Even before your birth, you left a stain on the carpet," she'd say. The stain, an amoeba-shaped discoloration that no cleaner known to man could remove, served for years as a reminder of my untimely arrival. Had my mother's water not broken, my father might never have moved from his beloved recliner positioned near the fireplace we used once a year to burn the Christmas wrapping paper. "Your father catapulted from his chair like it ejected him," my mother would say. "That's a bit of an exaggeration," my father would respond, still hidden behind his sports page. "Samuel, your father sprinted up those stairs," she'd say, gesturing over her shoulder to our staircase, "stuffed my clothes in a suitcase, and rushed out the front door." She dramatized the latter by flinging her arm as if slamming the door. I loved it. It was only after he threw my suitcase in the trunk and jumped behind the wheel that he realized he'd left me still struggling to get up from the couch. "Yes," my father would say, lowering the paper. "And by the time I got back to the house, your mother had already managed to not only get her coat and handbag from the closet, she'd also had the presence of mind to unplug every appliance in the house." This would send me into raucous laughter. Every trip, no matter how far from home, started with my mother worrying that she'd forgotten to unplug some appliance and lamenting the catastrophic fire she was certain it would cause. "The drive to Mercy Medical Center takes 8 minutes, Samuel. I made it in 5 minutes flat," my father would say with noticeable pride. "That's because you drove like a bat out of hell," my mother would say. My father would wink at me. I'd map the route through the back streets. "You rolled through every stop sign. You're lucky you didn't get a ticket." "With a pregnant woman in the car? I would have received a police escort." It turned out the rush was much ado about nothing. As my mother liked to say, "You were early, but you took your sweet time." Her labor lasted 32 hours, a number she would remind me of whenever I acted up. Still, the wait turned out to be nothing compared to the stir my arrival caused.
"You emerge with your eyes shut tight," my mother would say, speaking in a hushed whisper that mesmerized me.
In hindsight, I wondered if my entering this world with my eyes shut tight was a genetically predisposed instinct. My father, who'd chosen to remain down the hall in the hospital's waiting room, would at this point resume his narrative, explaining how the young doctor entered the room looking more perplexed than tired. He said, "It's a boy." But the doctor's rote proclamation did not temper my father's paternal instinct that something was amiss. "I sprinted down the tile linoleum into that room," he'd say. "And when I entered, I found a crowd of nurses and hospital staff hovering around your mother's bed like she was Marilyn Monroe." But my mother was not the object of their interest. It seemed that when the doctor had placed me upon my mother's stomach to cut the umbilical cord, I'd finally opened my eyes. And that's when the euphoria became bewilderment. The doctor froze, slack-jawed. The attending nurse let out a yip, which she belatedly tried to cover by placing her hand over her mouth. "Give me my son," my mother had said amid the silent stares, whereupon the nurse had swaddled me in a blanket and handed me to her. This was how my father found us when he waded through the crowd for a closer inspection and looked me in the eyes for the first time.
"What the Sam hell?"
he whispered.
3.
My father turned quickly to the obstetrician, who had entered the room and retaken his position at the foot of my mother's bed.
"His eyes are red." "Why are his eyes red?"
"I don't know," the doctor said.
"Will they stay that color?"
But back then the doctor didn't know, and he had little ability to research the question. He could only shrug. Another silence ensued, those present holding their collective breath, uncertain what to say or what to think of me. That's when my mother again took over.
"Out,"
she'd ordered. "I would like everyone to please leave." "That was our first private moment together as a family," she'd say when recounting the story. "Just you, me, and your father." Finally alone, my father started to ask the pertinent question. "Why are his..." But my mother was not interested in why my eyes were red, and she put up a hand to stop him. "I don't care why," she'd said. Several more minutes passed before my father, ever pragmatic, said,
"Well then, what shall we call him? We don't have a name."
Because of my premature arrival, they'd failed to reach a consensus. My mother suggested Maxwell, but my father had never cared for his name. He'd lobbied for William.
"But we do have a name," my mother said. "A beautiful name. A name his father has given him. Samuel. We'll call him Samuel."
And so, my father being Maxwell James Hill, I became Samuel James Hill. Sam Hill. Or, as I would soon become known, Sam Hell.
4.
My mother wasted no time doting on me and recording every detail of my life, as evidenced by the dozens of scrapbooks and photo albums she filled and kept on the mahogany bookshelves in our living room. When it came to my life, my mother acted as if she were preserving the legacy of a future president for his presidential library. Even before cameras digitally recorded the date on individual photographs, she would write the day, month, and year on the white borders to note such momentous occasions as my first bath, my first meal in a high chair, and the obligatory first potty training session. I also possessed the hospital beanie and ankle bracelet I wore home from the hospital, as well as every report card I earned and every high school newspaper article I wrote. Whether my mother's diligence was intended to document the extraordinary life she was convinced I was destined to lead, or simply the result of her having too much time on her hands,
I cannot say. But this meticulous recording of my life, along with the extended hours I would later spend with my father under the shade of that retirement center oak tree, allowed me to piece together much of these first years of my life. My mother, of course, deemed my red eyes to be God's will. And so, when some hospital administration types advised that hospital policy dictated I be examined by a specialist before I could be discharged, she turned them down cold. She suspected the hospital was more concerned with their potential legal liability than my health. "I'll sign a waiver," she said, "and we'll be out of your hair." My mother's suspicion was only partially accurate. It seems word of the child with red eyes traveled quickly throughout the hospital corridors and surrounding medical community, and there was no shortage of doctors eager to examine me. My mother brushed them aside as charlatans. "They were only interested in being published in the New England Journal of Medicine," she told me. My father, not a man to rock the boat, had suggested a compromise. "Perhaps we can allow one doctor to examine Samuel, just to be certain." My mother reluctantly consented, and both sides agreed upon Dr. Charles Pridemore, an ophthalmologist at the Stanford University Medical Center in Palo Alto. I don't know to what extent Dr. Pridemore educated my parents that day or on subsequent visits, but I soon became well-versed in my condition, the only word my mother would ever use to describe my eyes. A soft-spoken, bearded man of quiet dignity, Dr. Pridemore would become a lifelong mentor and friend. What I recall about him from my youth, however, was that he always had the appearance and demeanor of a slightly distracted science professor. Plaid shirts and wrinkled corduroys, an unkempt beard, wisps of curly hair protruding at odd angles, and glasses mottled with dust and fingerprints. "Ocular albinism," he'd later explained to me on one of my frequent visits, "is best understood with a rudimentary explanation of the components of the eye." He used a diagram hanging on the wall to show me the two layers of pigment in the iris. "There is the front, which we see, and the back, which we don't see, but which blocks light transmission. The iris without pigment is white," he'd explained, chewing hard on his ever-present stick of spearmint gum. "And the presence or absence of melanin in the iris accounts for the color of our eyes. A lot of melanin at the front results in brown eyes. No melanin in front, blue eyes. Some melanin and the eyes can appear green, hazel, and every shade in between, depending on the amount and distribution." "And what about red?" I had asked. "Technically, there is no such thing as red pigment." "But my eyes are red," I said. "And they were. Though let me clarify. I am not talking about fire engine glow-in-the-dark red, or even the red of a ripe apple. The color was more subtle, bordering on pink. But I'm also not an albino. Though I was born a towhead, my hair gradually darkened to its current nondescript light brown. And though I burn if I don't use sunblock, my skin pigmentation is otherwise normal. And that is how my mother considered me from the moment of my birth. Normal." In the hospital room, when Dr. Pridemore came to conduct his examination, she asked the only question that mattered to her. "Will it affect his vision?" But Dr. Pridemore did not know that answer in 1957, there being scant literature on the topic. "All I can say is that Samuel's eyes are very rare." "Not rare, doctor," my mother corrected. "Extraordinary." 5. My father dutifully called the few relatives I had with the news of my birth. My father had been an only child, born and raised in Chicago. He had lost his father to cancer 2 years before I was born. His German mother, whom I referred to as Oma Hill, made an annual sojourn to Burlingame for the Christmas holidays. Either my birth did not rate a separate visit, or my father politely steered her away from coming.
I presume my father thought it best to spare everyone Oma Hill's lamentations about all the pitfalls that awaited a child born with red eyes. Grandma O'Malley, on the other hand, rode the first bus from San Francisco to Burlingame, suitcase in hand. Also a widow, Grandma O'Malley had never possessed a driver's license and saw little need of obtaining one. She raised my mother and my Auntie Bonnie in a San Francisco Victorian in the Mission District, where the bus lines were plentiful, specialty shops abundant, and she could walk to St. James Catholic Church for morning mass. Unlike Oma Hill, Grandma O'Malley did not acknowledge afflictions, neuroses, diseases, or maladies, a trait I have since attributed to her Irish heritage. She apparently marched into my parents' bedroom, unswaddled me from my cocoon in the bassinet, and proclaimed, "Two eyes, two ears, 10 fingers, 10 toes, and a nose. Perfect." And that was her final word on the subject. 6. Sunday, 3 days after we arrived home from the hospital, my mother dressed me for my first visit to Our Lady of Mercy. It would take something far more severe than giving birth to keep my mother from attending Sunday Mass. My parents arrived early and marched down the long aisle to the third pew on the left, what would become our unwavering spot. My mother later would say this was so that God could note our presence, though a skeptic might believe it was to ensure a less divine being would take notice, our pastor, Father Brogan. Parishioners' regular attendance at Mass and their offerings in the weekly envelopes went a long way when it came time to enroll their children in OLM's crowded Catholic grammar school. Before slipping into the pew that first Sunday, my mother took me to the alcove just to the right of the altar to present me to the Blessed Mother of Jesus Christ. Mary stood atop a globe, dressed in a blue and white shawl, rosary beads in hand, and a snake crushed beneath her bare feet. It was the first of what would be many visits I would make to that alcove. That my parents' first encounter with intolerance would occur in church is less a commentary on Catholic hypocrisy than it is a testament to the frequency of their attendance. They were regular Sunday churchgoers, not Christmas Catholics, as my father dubbed those who attended Mass only on Christmas and Easter. Had my parents been as fervent about baseball, I'm sure the first inappropriate comment about the color of my eyes would have come from a child wearing a baseball cap and eating a hot dog. As it was, the offender was a young boy in blue knickers sitting in the pew behind us. "Mom," he apparently exclaimed, "what's wrong with that baby's eyes?" "What did you do?" I would ask when my mother recounted this story. "Why, I turned around and gave him a closer look," she'd say. Then I told him, "There's nothing wrong with his eyes. God made them that color. They're extraordinary." Following Mass, my mother also did not hesitate to present me to Father Brogan, a petite man with a white beard and thick Irish brogue. Father Brogan hid his shock. It was not possible that he did not notice. According to my father, the priest scooped me into his arms, lifted me overhead, and pronounced me to be a fine lad indeed. 7. In my 13th month, I took my first step, or so I was told. I found no snapshot to document this momentous occasion in the photo album labeled 1958. I do know that I took this step at home during a weekday, prompting my mother to stage a reenactment when my father arrived home from work so he could capture it on camera. Some months after my mother died, I found a cardboard box containing canisters of film in her attic. In the grainy, silent film documenting that day, I'm standing in a diaper with wobbly legs and clutching the corner of our living room coffee table. My mother is also in the film, clapping her hands and silently coaxing me to let go, without success. It seems that I had become distracted by my mother's rosary, alternately slapping the beads on the table or shoving them in my mouth and drooling. My mother, sensing an opportunity, took the rosary from me and dangled the silver cross just out of my reach. "Walk for Mary," she mouthed on the film. "Walk for Mary, Samuel." And that was when I responded, though not with my first step. In those black and white frames, My mother suddenly stopped clapping. Her eyes shifted from me to the camera a fraction of a second before my father dropped it. By the time he had recovered, I was in mid-walk, reaching for the dangling crucifix, a feat completely overshadowed by what had been my first uttered word. "Mary," I'd said. To my mother, of course, this was solid evidence to support her conviction that God had a divine plan for me and my red eyes. If someone had told her that someday white smoke would rise above the Vatican before the proclamation of my name as Pope, she would not so much have batted an eye. She immediately went to work to ensure that when that momentous occasion did occur, I would not embarrass her, as I did each time she took me to buy a new pair of shoes and I revealed holes in my socks. By age 5, I could recite the Lord's Prayer, the Hail Mary, and the Glory Be, which meant I could recite the Rosary. This tutelage often occurred at night, with me holding my own rosary and mimicking her devotion, and just as frequently on trips to kneel before the statue of the Blessed Mother in the alcove of the church. "Prayers are like coins deposited in a piggy bank, Samuel," my mother assured me. "Save them until you need them for something important." And so I would silently recite the rosary and deposit my prayers in my prayer piggy bank, comforted by the knowledge that they would be there when the need presented itself, which would be much sooner than I anticipated. 8. While I do not specifically recollect my enrollment at OLM, like my birth, it is a story I heard often enough to tell with authority of fact. A newspaper article in the scrapbook marked 1963 also helped fill in the blanks, and what I cannot document, I can deduce from a profound understanding of my mother and her steadfast and unyielding insistence that her son would receive a Catholic education. And God help anyone who got in her way. The envelope from OLM's admissions office arrived in our mailbox the week before the start of the school year. Both that envelope and the letter it contained became keepsakes in my mother's scrapbook. Though the paper has yellowed and the typewritten font has faded, I remember the envelope my mother pulled from our mailbox as having been a bright white, almost as bright as my mother's smile that afternoon. "Isn't this exciting, Samuel?" Her smile quickly faded upon reading the letter. "We are sorry to advise that your application for enrollment in the first grade at Our Lady of Mercy has been denied." Unfortunately, Our Lady of Mercy did not have enough spots for every applicant. That evening, after we'd finished dinner, my mother handed my father the letter along with a cup of coffee. Upon reading it, my father placed the letter face down on the kitchen table, momentarily stumped. "The public school is very good," he'd eventually said with some degree of caution. "Given Samuel's condition, perhaps it's better not to draw attention to the situation. He can attend CCD, and of course there's no better religion teacher than you." My mother added 2 lumps of sugar to his coffee and poured the cream in his lap. To his credit, my father hardly flinched. He simply excused himself to change his pants. The son of Madeline Hill, whose first uttered word had been the name of the Blessed Mother of Jesus Christ, would not attend public school. Of this, my mother was quite certain. 9. The following sun-drenched Monday morning, my mother dressed me in the school uniform she had purchased in anticipation of this big day, a short-sleeved white shirt, navy blue pants, and a red sweater. We drove first to the church, where we knelt in the alcove before the Blessed Mother. "You might want to consider opening your prayer bank," my mother suggested. "But after years of saving, I couldn't bear to do it. Instead, I mentally pulled the rubber stopper on the bottom and shook out just 1 or 2. "What do I pray for?" I whispered. My mother did not raise her head or open her eyes. "Righteousness," she whispered. After our visit to the church, my mother parked on Cortez Avenue and marched me up the steep red steps to the wrought iron gated entrance to the OLM school quad. Built in 1932, This older section of OLM, like the homes nearby, had been influenced by Spanish architecture and consisted of salmon-colored stucco walls with rounded archways and red tile roofs. 8 mahogany doors faced an inner courtyard of red concrete slabs with an elevated white statue of the Blessed Mother at the epicenter. I felt the eyes of every student watching our assault as we marched up the stairs, through that quad, and across the asphalt playground. Our destination was the admissions office in the modern portion of the school. I would subsequently learn that the admissions office was readily accessed from the adjacent block, Cabrillo Avenue, but that would have been far too subtle an entrance for my mother. She wasn't interested in just rocking this boat. She intended to capsize it. Sister Beatrice, OLM's principal, met us in an austere lobby. She wore her solid black habit, which fell in folds from her throat to her shins, cinched at the waist by a woven wool girdle from which hung a black rosary and ebony cross. Add to this a black wimple, thick black framed glasses, a prominent nose, and 2 equally prominent front incisors, and I was certain I was staring at the Wicked Witch of the West. I was terrified.
"How can I help you, Mrs. Hill?"
Sister Beatrice asked, pleasantly enough. "I'm here to enroll my son Samuel in the first grade," my mother replied.
"Did you receive my letter?"
Sister Beatrice asked. My mother held up the envelope. "I did indeed."
"Then you understand why that is not going to occur today."
"To the contrary," my mother said. "That is exactly why I am here, to see that it does occur today. I don't want Samuel to fall behind a single day." Sister Beatrice's lips puckered, making the wisps of black hair adorning her upper lip twitch.
"I am the principal of this school, Mrs. Hill. As the principal, it is my obligation to make decisions that are in the best interests of the child."
"To which child are you referring?" my mother asked, both women still cordial at this point. Sister Beatrice frowned.
"Why, yours, of course."
"Really? You're going to make a decision in the best interests of Samuel? Before you do, tell me, sister, if you would be so kind, all of the things that you know about Samuel."
"Excuse me?"
"With the exception of the color of his eyes, of which I am quite certain you are fully aware." Until that moment, Sister Beatrice had never once considered me. When her gaze shifted to my face, I felt an instant lump in my throat. She folded her arms, and her hands disappeared in the wide sleeves of her habit.
"I beg your pardon."
"I ask that you tell me everything you can about Samuel, sister."
"I've never met the boy."
"Precisely. So I fail to see how you are in the position to be making a decision that is in Samuel's best interests." At this proclamation, I noticed several of the office women seated behind the wood laminate counter raise their heads and put aside any pretense of being engaged in work. Apparently, Sister Beatrice was rarely, if ever, challenged.
"Perhaps we should continue this conversation inside my office."
"Perhaps we should," my mother agreed. Sister Beatrice spun a swirl of black cloth and marched into her office. She turned and raised a hand to stop me from proceeding. "The boy will wait in the lobby."
"Samuel will not wait in the lobby. As this is a matter that involves him directly, he will need to be present. I believe it will be an insightful lesson for him on Catholic compassion and empathy."
Lips pursed, Sister Beatrice gestured to 2 cloth chairs across from a metal desk. I followed my mother inside and sat. If the lobby was austere, Sister Beatrice's office was downright Spartan. Photographs of Pope Paul VI and our pastor, Father Brogan, hung side by side on one wall. On the otherwise spotless desk sat a 6-inch cactus that looked in desperate need of water. Sister Beatrice's posture was impeccable, back straight and hands folded on her desk blotter. My mother's spine, likewise, never touched the back of her chair. And yet, she still managed to cross her legs. I didn't dare slouch.
"This is a private school, Mrs. Hill. Father Brogan has seen fit to make me its principal. As such, I have the authority to decline admittance to any child." This school is not subject to the admissions requirements that govern public institutions. In other words, you have the right to discriminate in the name of God. Sister Beatrice's face flushed. It is not discrimination. It is careful analysis. My mother smiled, and I could not help but think her beautiful in her black and white checked wool skirt and matching jacket, a simple strand of pearls adorning her neck. With blonde hair and blue eyes, my mother always had a youthful appearance, and I would learn, to my horror, an hourglass figure that would generate catcalls well into her 40s. My father called her a looker, which in my day equated to a total babe. "Tell me, sister, would you have denied enrollment to Samuel had he been black?" Sister Beatrice bristled. "Of course not. Chinese? No. Russian?" She hesitated, it being the Cold War. "No. My son is of German-Irish descent. He was baptized Catholic in the church at the end of this school's playground. My husband and I have been faithful and generous parishioners. Samuel can recite the Our Father, the Hail Mary, and the Act of Contrition. He can make the sign of the cross and knows how to say the rosary. So explain to me, if you will, on what basis you have chosen to deny him admission." "It is my belief that because of certain attributes, your son's presence in the classroom would be detrimental to the learning environment of the other children. You denied Samuel admission because he was born with red eyes, a condition over which he has no control. I believe it will be difficult for your son to fit in, to make friends." My mother started to speak, and Sister Beatrice added, "The children refer to him as Sam Hell." "Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, what does that have to do with they call him the devil boy?" My mother flinched. So did I, having been well versed in the concept of the devil. "As such, I think your son could be a disruption to the classroom, a distinct likelihood to which we all must be sensitive," Sister Beatrice finished. "But not to Samuel," my mother said, quickly recovering. "Excuse me? You think it's right to be sensitive to the possibility that other children will be insensitive, unchristian, un-Catholic, un-Christ-like," she said, "but not to be sensitive to a 6-year-old boy whom God created and whom God gave red eyes. Nevertheless, I have 23 other students in the first grade to consider." "Then perhaps you should consider that Samuel's presence might very well be a perfect opportunity to put into practice some of the principles to which this school and this parish give lip service, to love one another and to display compassion to those who are different. I can assure you, Mrs. Hill, this school very much enforces Christian ideals. These being the days of wooden rulers and bullet-tipped pointers, Sister Beatrice's use of the word enforce had surely been intended. At the moment, I think you can appreciate that your words ring rather hollow, sister. Now, since there is no justifiable reason not to enroll Samuel, kindly advise me to whom I should write a check to cover his tuition and into which classroom he will be placed." The two women locked eyes. There ensued a sickening moment of silence. Sister Beatrice broke the deadlock. "As I said, that is not going to happen, Mrs. Hill. I have made my decision." My mother stood. "Then I will have to make mine. Samuel?" Taking that as my cue, and grateful for it, I stood to leave. My mother opened the office door, and though she turned to face Sister Beatrice, she kept her voice loud enough for all in the outer office to hear. "I will pray for you, sister." With that pronouncement, she left. I trudged out behind her, stumbling into her legs when she stopped to address the two women behind the counter. "Prepare yourselves, ladies. It's about to get very busy." 10. "Don't listen to a word that woman uttered," my mother said as she shuffled me back across the courtyard, this time without an audience. The students were already in their classrooms. "A woman like that shames the habit she is wearing." Without further word, we climbed into the convertible Falcon and drove off, though not in the direction of our home. I can recall thinking my mother was driving straight to my father's store, but we passed Broadway Avenue without slowing. "Where are we going?" I asked. "To see a college friend," she said. We continued south on the El Camino Real to a nondescript high-rise building and parked in a lot beside multiple white vans with the number 4 stenciled on the sides. Inside the building, my mother sat me in a chair in a reception area while she went to address a woman behind the counter. A minute later, a man in a shirt and tie with perfect teeth and hair that looked like it could withstand 50-mile-an-hour wind gusts greeted her with a hug and, to my astonishment, a kiss on the cheek. My mother beckoned me forward. "Samuel, this is Dan, an old college friend." Dan bent down to shake my hand. "Hi there, Sam. How would you like something to drink and a morning snack?" I looked to my mom, who nodded her consent. "Emily," Dan said to the woman behind the counter, "can you take Sam to the lunchroom and get him a juice and snack?" I wasn't sure about leaving my mother with a man who so easily kissed her, but I was also hungry, having not been able to stomach much for breakfast that morning. "No problem," Emily said, coming out from behind the counter. She stopped suddenly, staring at me. "And get Sam some paper and colored markers to pass the time," Dan said. But Emily must not have heard him. "Emily?"
"What's that?"
she asked, breaking off eye contact with me. "I said, get Sam some paper and colored markers." Emily looked to my mother, whose eyebrows arched.
"Right, markers. Sure, not a problem."
I remember thinking it must have been everyone's break time because a considerable number of people came into the lunchroom while I was drawing and eating my snack. By the time my mother and Dan finally returned, I had filled 3 sheets of blank paper with multiple drawings. Dan was now wearing a checked sports coat. "Don't you worry," he said, giving my mother another hug, though thankfully not another kiss. "We'll take care of it." 11. That evening, I was in my room feeling a certain dread, though I'm equally certain I could not have fully understood what was transpiring. When my mother called me down to dinner, I closed the book I was supposed to be reading and walked to the bathroom across the hall. I rinsed my hands under the tap and dried them on my pants, sprinkling water on the soap in the dish in case my mother checked. Standing at the sink, I looked into the mirror and stared at the 2 red circles gazing back at me. It is my first recollection of looking upon my reflection and wondering why I was different. "Devil boy," I said, despite my mother's admonition not to listen to a word Sister Beatrice had said. How could I not? I'd been standing right there when she'd said it. "Devil boy," I said again, leaning closer to my reflection. "Devil boy."
"Samuel, I am not going to call you again."
I turned off the bathroom light and hurried downstairs. My father, seated in his recliner, motioned me over as I jumped down the final 2 steps.
"I hear you had quite the day," he whispered. "You know, Jefferson Elementary, where I had attended kindergarten, is a very good school. I spoke to the principal, and they'd be delighted to have you continue there."
"I don't know," I said. My father winked.
"These things have a way of working themselves out, Sam. No use rocking the boat. You only take on more water."
At that, my mother pronounced dinner served, and my father and I proceeded to the kitchen. My mother sanctified our dinner ritual as much as our attendance at Mass. Our evening meal began promptly after my father finished his Manhattan. As in church, we each had our assigned places at the table. We did not begin passing food until after we had joined hands and said grace. Upon uttering amen, I was to take my napkin and place it in my lap while my mother commenced serving. I was not allowed to slouch or put my elbows on the table, and I was expected to liberally use the words please and thank you. Can I was forbidden. May I, my mother would correct. Dinner conversation also had a set of rules. We were expected to discuss our days, though not anything unsettling. "It will disrupt your digestion," my mother would say. Despite these regulations, I recall our dinners together fondly. I enjoyed hearing my father discuss the comings and goings at the pharmacy, and I wanted very much to someday follow in his footsteps. When we entered the kitchen this evening, however, my father came to a sudden stop, staring at our black and white portable television with rabbit ear antenna on the Formica counter.
I had last seen it the day my father placed it in the hall closet, replacing it with the RCA Victor in the living room. I would have found it less unusual had a bear walked in at that moment and sat at the table. So, apparently, would have my father. "We're eating dinner with the TV on?" my father asked. "I want to watch the news." My mother set a bowl of green beans on the table without further explanation for this serious breach in dinner protocol. "Samuel, did you wash your hands?"
"Yes."
"With soap?"
I looked to my father, but he remained dumbstruck by the television.
"Go into the bathroom and use soap," my mother said. I used the bathroom just beneath the staircase and again considered my eyes in the mirror. They looked the same as they had that morning, but I didn't feel the same. All of this breach in protocol was upsetting my stomach. My father had taken his customary seat, but my mother continued to break tradition, sitting where I normally sat to better view the television. She pointed to her usual chair. "You sit there tonight, Samuel." She reached across the table and grabbed my hand, and I took my father's to complete the circle. After saying grace, my mother passed me a plate of fried chicken. I took a leg while sneaking a glance over my shoulder at the television. "Put your napkin in your lap," she said. "Is there something in particular you're interested in watching?" my father asked. My mother passed him the green beans as a washed-out image of Walter Cronkite looked into the camera and signed off.
"And that's the way it is, September 4th, 1963.
I assumed the channel went to commercial because I recall asking, "Can I have the potatoes?" "Please pass the potatoes," my mother corrected. "Please pass the potatoes," I said. My father got as far as picking up the bowl when the local newscast began.
"Today in Burlingame, a Catholic school denied admittance to a young boy because he was born with a rare genetic condition that causes the irises of his eyes to be red."
My father dropped the bowl. My mother appeared on the grainy television, standing beside Dan, a microphone under her chin and Sister Beatrice's letter in her hand. It seems that when it comes to Catholic values, Our Lady of Mercy is good at preaching them, but not at practicing them, my mother said to Dan. "My son is no different from any other child, save for the color of his eyes, over which he has no control." Our Lady of Mercy's school grounds appeared on the television, the shot angling up at the quad from the lower parking lot. It then switched to a close-up of the salmon-colored door of the administration office. The blinds had been drawn to cover the thin sidelights. Dan peered into the camera.
"Attempts to contact the school principal, Sister Beatrice, were not successful," he said, tone grave.
The camera shot returned to my mother standing beside Dan in the parking lot. She said the decision was hers alone to make, so I can only assume she speaks for the entire parish.
"But that appears not to be the case," the newscaster said, and I recognized the sudden appearance of our pastor, Father Brogan, dressed in his mud-brown Franciscan frock.
"This is clearly a misunderstanding," Father Brogan said to Dan. He looked uncomfortable. "Here at OLM, we do far more than preach Catholic ideals. I can assure you, they are very much put into practice."
Dan asked, "So, is there any truth to the assertion that the boy was denied admittance because of the color of his eyes?"
Father Brogan looked pale, even on the washed-out screen.
"We had more applicants than space," he managed. "We certainly do not discriminate at OLM."
With that pronouncement, my mother returned to the screen beside Dan. This time, she sounded more conciliatory.
"We're hopeful that this misunderstanding will be quickly rectified."
The newscast moved on to the next story. My father and I sat as if frozen. "Samuel, turn off the television," my mother said, piercing a green bean with her fork and bringing it to her mouth. The click of the knob was the last sound I recall until the telephone down the hall rang. My mother casually transferred her napkin from her lap to the table and left to answer it.
"Hill Residence, this is Mrs. Hill."
Pause.
"It's nice of you to call, Father Brogan."
Another pause.
"No. As a matter of fact, we were just finishing up."
Longer pause.
"I understand. Of course. These things do happen.
Samuel is very much looking forward to it. I looked to my father. He sat rigid, his face red. My mother continued to speak into the phone. We'd like to have you to dinner one evening, Father. Yes, we'll have to do that. I heard her replace the receiver in its cradle,